From Thunderbirds to Pterodactyls and the Book of the Month show with Jill Appleton, Jill Prowse, and Rob Nichols, this is Shane Rimmer congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this podcast.
So, ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you to show your appreciation for welcome to the Book of the Month Live? Thank you.
As part of the Middlesbrough Literary Festival celebration, we are recording an extra Book of the Month programme for June, and it is a great pleasure to be recording it live from one of our libraries here in Thorntree. Today we are looking at a real classic, The 39 Steps, written by John Buchan way back in 1915. The story takes place just 4 weeks before World War I and tells the tale of Richard Hannay's entanglement with international spies and a German plot to steal British military secrets.
I told Paddock a fine story about how my friend was a great swell, with his nerves pretty bad from overwork, who wanted absolute rest and stillness. Nobody had got to know he was here, or he would be besieged by communications from the India Office and the Prime Minister, and his cure would be ruined. I'm bound to say, Scudder played up splendidly when he came to breakfast. He fixed Paddock with his eyeglass, just like a British officer, asked him about the Boer War, and slung out at me a lot of stuff about imaginary pals. Paddock couldn't learn to call me sir, but he sirred Scudder as if his life depended on it. I left him with the newspaper and a box of cigars, and went down to the city till luncheon. When I got back, the lift man had an important face. "Nasty business here this morning, sir. Gentry number 15 been and shot himself. They've just took him to the mortuary. The police are up there now." I ascended to number 15 and found a couple of bobbies and an inspector busy making an examination. I asked a few idiotic questions and they soon kicked me out. Then I found the man that had valeted Scudder and pumped him. But I could see he suspected nothing. He was a whining fellow with a churchyard face, and half a crown went far to console him. I attended the inquest next day. A partner of some publishing firm gave evidence that the deceased had brought him woodpulp propositions and had been, he believed, an agent of an American business. The jury found it a case of suicide while of unsound mind, and the few effects were handed over to the American consul to deal with. I gave Scudder a full account of the affair, and it interested him greatly. He said he wished he could have attended the inquest, for he reckoned it would be about as spicy as to read one's own obituary notice. The first 2 days he stayed with me in that back room, he was very peaceful. He read and smoked a bit, and made a heap of jottings in a notebook, and every night we had a game of chess, at which he beat me hollow. I think he was nursing his nerves back to health, for he had had a pretty trying time, but on the third day I could see he was beginning to get restless. He fixed up a list of the days till June 15th, and ticked each off with a red pencil, making remarks in shorthand against them. I would find him sunk in a brown study, with his sharp eyes abstracted, and after those spells of meditation, he was apt to be very despondent. Then I could see that he began to get edgy again. He listened for little noises, and was always asking me if Paddock could be trusted. Once or twice, he got very peevish and apologised for it. I didn't blame him. I made every allowance, for he had taken on a fairly stiff job. It was not the safety of his own skin that troubled him, but the success of the scheme he had planned. That little man was clean grit all through, without a soft spot in him. One night, he was very solemn. "Say, Hanny," he said, "I judge I should let you a bit deeper into this business. I should hate to go out without leaving somebody else to put up a fight." And he began to tell me in detail what I had only heard from him vaguely. I did not give him very close attention. The fact is, I was more interested in his own adventures than in his high politics. I reckoned that Karolides and his affairs were not my business, leaving all that to him. So a lot that he said slipped clean out of my memory. I remember that he was very clear that the danger to Karolides would not begin till he had got to London, and would come from the very highest quarters, where there would be no thought of suspicion. He mentioned the name of a woman, Julia Checheny, as having something to do with the danger. She would be the decoy, I gathered, to get Karolides out of the care of his guards. He talked, too, about a black stone and a man that lisped in his speech. And he described very particularly somebody that he never referred to without a shudder. An old man with a young voice who could hood his eyes like a hawk.
Richard Hannay is finding life since returning from southern Africa boring at home in London. He is considering moving on when his upstairs neighbour begs him to let him stay in his flat. He tells him he has uncovered a plot to murder the Greek premier, Karolides, and steal British plans for the outbreak of war. The neighbour called Franklin P. Scudder now thinks that there are dangerous people after him, so has faked his own death. He asks Hannay if he can hide in his flat for a while until the dust settles. Hannay decides to help him, but when he arrives home to discover the man murdered, he realises that his own life is now in danger. Heading for Galloway in Scotland, Hannay goes on the run, hoping to remain undetected until the date of the assassination, so he can try to prevent the murder of another innocent man.
Very soon after daybreak, I made an attempt to clean myself in a hill burn, and then approached a herd's cottage, for I was feeling the need of food. The herd was away from home, and his wife was alone, with no neighbour for 5 miles. She was a decent old body, and a plucky one, for though she got a fright when she saw me, she had an axe handy, and would have used it on any evildoer. I told her that I had had a fall, I didn't say how, and she saw by my looks that I was pretty sick. Like a true Samaritan, she asked no questions, but gave me a bowl of milk with a dash of whiskey in it, and let me sit for a while by her kitchen fire. She would have bathed my shoulder, but it ached so badly that I would not let her touch it. I don't know what she took me for, a repentant burglar perhaps, for when I wanted to pay her for the milk and tendered a sovereign, which was the smallest coin I had, she shook her head and said something about giving it to them that had a right to it. At this I protested so strongly that I think she believed me honest, for she took the money and gave me a warm new plaid for it and an old hat of her man's. She showed me how to wrap the plaid round my shoulders, and when I left the cottage I was the living image of the kind of Scotsman you see in the illustrations to Burns' poems. But, at any rate, I was more or less clad. It was as well, for the weather changed before midday to a thick drizzle of rain. I found shelter below an overhanging rock in the crook of a burn, where a drift of dead brackens made a tolerable bed. There I managed to sleep till nightfall, waking very cramped and wretched, with my shoulder gnawing like a toothache. I ate the oatcake and cheese the old wife had given me, and set out again just before the darkening. I pass over the miseries of that night among the wet hills. There were no stars to steer by, and I had to do the best I could from my memory of the map. Twice I lost my way, and I had some nasty falls into peat bogs. I had only about 10 miles to go as the crow flies, but my mistakes made it nearer 20. The last bit was completed with set teeth, and a very light and dizzy head, but I managed it, and in the early dawn I was knocking at Mr. Turnbull's door. The mist lay close and thick, and from the cottage I could not see the high road. Mr. Turnbull himself opened to me, sober and something more than sober. He was primly dressed in an ancient but well-tended suit of black. He had been shaved not later than the night before. He wore a linen collar, and in his left hand he carried a pocket Bible. At first, he did not recognise me. "Why ye that comes stravaging here on the Sabbath morning?" he asked. I had lost all count of the days. So, the Sabbath was the reason for his strange decorum. My head was swimming so wildly that I could not frame a coherent answer. But he recognised me, and he saw that I was ill.
Hannay is chased across the wilds of Scotland by a mysterious, unknown enemy, and also the police who suspect him of the murder of Scudder. At the same time, Hannay is desperately trying to unlock the secrets of the murder plot that are written in code in Scudder's diary. He knows he could save the day if only he could discover what the 39 steps means before it's too late. There are plenty of frantic chase scenes, and Hannay needs to use all his wits and cunning to remain free. This book is short, just 160 pages, but is full of action from start to finish. This will appeal to anyone who enjoys a thrilling edge-of-your-seat ride.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you and welcome to Book of the Month Live. As we said, we need to introduce, for the benefit of our listeners, the team and the panel today. We have, sitting next to me actually, the fabulous author of Death of the Elven Man and a whole heap of other scenarios featuring Alex Hastings and a whole range of other factors, the fabulous Jenny Finch. Regular to Book of the Month, of course, we have Rob Nichols, editor of Fly Me to the Moon, the fanzine, music contributor to the Evening Gazette, and indeed regular musician himself. Also making a debut on the show from Middlesbrough Library Services, the first time she's ever actually been able to make a show, because normally they're recorded on a Friday, we have Ruth Cull. And Jill Appleton as well, joining myself, Alex Leftuke. So, let's move on, and let's talk to Jenny first and foremost. Jenny, your thoughts on John Buchan's The 39 Steps.
I first read 39 Steps at school, and it seemed a very strange choice for a girls' high school. We were all about 12. When I reread it, I was surprised at how short it was, and I was also surprised at how... not thin. He uses small amounts of description that in your head become large amounts of description and big pictures. And he does it so well. But overwhelmingly, the story is the thing. It's like a literary car chase across the moors. But the other thing that struck me is how much of the time it is, in that it assumes you know the language, which is different. It assumes you know the background. And it's very class-ridden, which didn't occur to me at the time. I read it 40-odd years ago. But looking back now, it's got a whole heap of assumptions that younger people might look at and go, what is he talking about? And yet, when you get past that, it's one of the best rip-roaring yarns I've ever read. And I actually went on to read other stuff by John Buchan and enjoyed it enormously. And I think I might revisit them.
Okay. Ruth?
I must be one of these younger people who didn't understand a lot of it. I mean, I read a lot of thrillers, and I personally didn't feel it stood up against more modern thrillers. I found it was filled with coincidence. Sir so-and-so from the club happens to drive past at just the opportune moment. It just took it too far for me, I think, and I wasn't convinced by it, I should say.
Rob?
When you read it now, you either picture Robert Donat or Robert Powell, and it is definitely written a period piece, but just like you, Jenny, after reading it, I read Prester John and some of his other books, and they go into very imperialist, and well, there's a few pages that are out and out racist, I think, in Prester John. So it very much is of its time, but that's something that I really like about this book, because apart from being the chase, it's that you feel that you're part of that period, and it is quite an exciting climax it comes towards, doesn't it, drawing towards all the way through the book.
In addition to the movies that you said, and obviously the movie interpretations, the thing that struck me was how much writers such as Ian Fleming and Leslie Charteris actually owe to John Buchan, because as a template for sort of starting off that chase sequence, there were parts of me when I was reading through The Chase Across the Highlands that said, well, actually, this is From Russia With Love, transposed to the Scottish Highlands. You've got those sort of adventures coming through in terms of that. Go back to yourself, Ruth, again. Would you sort of be any more sympathetic if we sort of looked upon it as the first or one of the first of its kind of genre, its style?
I suppose so. It does set a template. I think we're used to more sophistication now, and it does seem very basic when you read it. But as you say, it's of the time, isn't it? And I think it's probably done quite well as well because he's written it just after the outbreak of the First World War, and he's come to it with causes that lead up to that. I think that's quite clever to do it at the time.
Might be wavering there slightly. Let's go to Jenny, because obviously as a writer of thrillers in many ways, countries, the sort of areas there where you think, if you take away the cultural issues relating to gender stereotypes, I mean, actually, apart from the Scottish wife, and there are very few notable female characters in 39 Steps. I mean, even the movie adaptations tended to have a greater, stronger role for women within the press. Did you think that technically it's a well-written piece?
I think it's very well constructed. Yes, it does have those coincidences in it, but I think the whole thing holds together very well. And there are a few moments that are... I remember being genuinely frightened by the man who could hood his eyes like a hawk. Gave me nightmares when I was 12. And reading it again, that is such a good invention. And he runs through as an underlying threat. And that not knowing who your adversary is, not giving him a name, but having him just appear and then sink down again, that is a wonderful device, and I think it's something a lot of people, including me, I admit, we have stolen it and we have used it, and it is, this man invented it, I think. Credit to him.
Okay. Jill, your point of view, how did you find the sequence? Did you go more down the line of Ruth? Or?
Probably, yeah, I think I'm probably agreeing a bit more with Ruth. I did struggle to... I thought it was quite clever from the first page. There was action, things happening straight away. He didn't mess around, you know. We were just saying that a lot of these classics are quite short, aren't they, that we've read over time at Book of the Month, where you get these new books, some of them are...
The word processor has lots to answer
huge,
for,
aren't they? Yeah, they just get straight to the point and get straight in there. So it was, yeah, there's lots going on, and it was plenty of action in there, but... people were so trusting in them days, weren't they? Let anybody in the house would just and feed them and clothe them and let them use the car and everything. It just seemed a bit odd.
Okay, I mean, it's in terms of that, I mean, obviously, you're right. I think it does actually move along at a cracking pace. And I think, like yourself, sometimes we talk about the art of good writing is brevity, or you can actually, or editing, shall we say, ruthless editing. But so put it up to the audience. Anybody got any questions or thoughts or any show of hands, who's actually sort of read 39 Steps? Gentleman at the back, okay.
A very long time ago, yeah.
Okay.
As a panel, so
39 Steps, yeah.
Most of my memories are from the film, yeah. It glams up, to say the least.
Right. I mean, we'll get the sort of panel's marks out of 10 in a few moments, but I mean, were there any particular highlights from the original reading which you thought, yes, that was good? I mean, can you see it acting as that precursor to kind of contemporary adventurers?
I think his attempt, when he was road mending, his attempt to put the spies up who were chasing him by actually not only assuming the identity of the road mender, but becoming the road mender, because if this spies half suspected him, they would kill him on the spot. That was the same thing.
Yeah. From what we've actually heard, anybody likely to be reading 39 Steps, the original sort of thing that we actually heard, just a show of hands, did you? Yes.
Oh, well, I read it half a century ago. It was the set book for my O-levels. And I haven't read it since. And I intended to read it before I came here, but I'm afraid I didn't. So, yes, I will read it again. And it hadn't occurred to me until Jenny said, you can see, because I've been reading thrillers ever since, I can see how Ian Fleming, Leslie Charteris, excuse me, in The Saint, have sort of adapted the formula. He really does seem to be the sort of precursor of most modern...
And, of course, the centenary of 39 Steps comes around in 2 years' time, 2015. So, interesting slot. It happened in 100 years. Okay, let's cut to the quick here. It's time for marks out of 10 in terms of the line, I think. Let's go with Ruth to start off with.
I've got to go with a 6.
A 6, okay. Jenny?
I'd give it an 8.
Yeah. Okay. Rob?
I'll go for 8.5.
Yeah. I think I'm going to go for 8 as well, actually. It's sort of a couple of areas where, you know, we're looking at it from a 21st century viewpoint, the 20th century, we might have sort of changed things around, but as an adventure thing, I think it worked well. And Jill?
I'll go for 7.
That's
That's good for me.
It is highly, exactly. Excellent. Okay, well, this has been part of the Middlesbrough Book Festival, obviously 2013. Lots of other events still to actually come up. We've got the Andy Kershaw at the Mink Bar tomorrow. Jill, anything else you want to just flag up that's happening as far as the festival is concerned?
Yeah, well, tonight at Central Library, there's a talk on Jack the Ripper. So if you like a bit of crime, that's maybe something you'd like to go to. There's lots of events, lots of we've got a writing workshop here this afternoon. We've got a poetry event on Saturday. There's lots of things to come up this week.
And the July Book of the Month, which you're more than welcome to actually either take part in or indeed sort of listen to on southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com, is
Sarah Pinborough, A Matter of Blood.
Contemporary thriller and indeed speculative fiction as well. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for actually helping us produce the first ever on location version of Book of the Month. We hope you'll be able to access the piece via the southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com website. You've listened to the shows, haven't you, Jenny, before?
I have, yes.
Excellent. There we are. And has been featured within the whole thing. But for now, can I ask you to join me in showing my appreciation for Jill Appleton, Ruth Curl, Rob Nichols and Jenny Finch. Thank you.
Being chosen as an author for the Southside Book of the Month with Jill Appleton is one of life's top honors. Now on to the Booker Prize for Literature.